music from Carolyn Ahrens, An Eternity in Our Hearts, the name of the song. Bobby McFerrin along with Esperanza Spalding just before that in their song Glory. It's 10 minutes exactly past the hour of 8 here in the Central Time Zone of East Dakota. We're Broken Road Radio. Dr. Don Clark joins us. Don from Garden Valley, Texas this morning. Don is a biochemist and a member of the Board of Creation Moments, and just a delightful guy to have around because he explains things to us, don't you, Don? In the scientific manner of things.
I try to. I hope, you know, our listeners can understand, as, you know, some of the topics we talk about. But I try to put it in a way that we, you know, we can all understand and come away with at least a little bit of more understanding and knowledge.
And you do a marvelous job of that, too. We were really heavily into DNA the last couple of weeks here, but it was fascinating. But the way you explained it made sense of it, and it doesn't often happen. Well, now, today I'm looking at an article from Live Science. Beautiful photograph here. At least I think it's a photo as opposed to an artistic rendering. I'm not sure. But it claims to be the Zika virus I'm looking at. And the question around this picture is the Zika virus alive? And for that matter, is any virus truly alive? What does it take to be considered alive? You think we'd all know that by instinct. But it's been a discussion of philosophers and scientists and even the theologist for centuries. What does it take to be alive by scientific definition?
Well, it's an interesting question. We may even have covered it here on the Broken Road Radio at one point in time, but it must. There are certain conditions of being alive. Must respond to stimulus, for example. It must grow over time. I mean, it can't stay static. It must produce offspring. Or at least have the ability to produce offspring, maintain a stable body temperature, at least for the warm-blooded animals, for example.
There's a word for that. Was it entropy? Is that the word you've used for that? Maintaining.
No, entropy is just a form of energy.
Okay.
It must be, but talking about energy, it must be able to metabolize energy. In other words, mm-hmm. we take in sugars and other vitamins and stuff and minerals, and then we can metabolize the sugar and make energy out of it, and that's mm-hmm. what keeps us going. It must consist of one or more cells, and it must adapt to their environment. Now, not all of these conditions are necessary for life, but you'd have to have a good number of them to be considered. This is actual life.
Maybe like a majority of the seven. 4 out of 7 is good enough, huh?
Well. For example, you don't necessarily have to maintain a constant body temperature to be alive. I mean, everybody would think that, okay, plants are indeed alive because mm-hmm. Some of the plants we can actually see growing. as far as animals are concerned, one would put in the condition of at least maintaining a certain body temperature. By some means, either internally or externally, by sitting on a rock and mm-hmm. absorbing the sun, for example, with reptiles.
But one of the requirements you mentioned was the ability to reproduce yourself, or the animal, or the plant to be alive. But then I think of mules, you know, who are sterile, cannot reproduce themselves, and yet, at last check, mules were living creatures.
That's exactly right. But they are obviously a kind of a hybrid between a donkey and a horse. And we know horses can reproduce and donkeys can reproduce. And this man-made hybrid, their DNA is close enough. They probably would all be considered in the same biblical kind that we were mm-hmm. talking about last week. The mule is, while it's a useful animal, it doesn't have the ability to reproduce, you know, on its own. So
okay, so it meets, let's say, 6 out of the 7 requirements then, And there are other exceptions, too. And, of course, the topic this morning is the definition of life. But does a virus qualify as living? Because they're missing that ability to reproduce themselves in themselves, aren't they?
Well, they are, because all the virus is basically either RNA or DNA, and it's a packet of RNA or DNA, and there's proteins around the genetic information, if you will, in order to keep it stable. But there's also kind of receptors on the outside of a virus that say, hey, there's a living something that's around me, and now I can release the RNA or the DNA into the cell. And then once it does that, it overtakes the machinery of the cell to make more of itself. And one would scratch their head and say, gee, that sounds like life. But it doesn't have the ability on its own.
So it sounds parasitic. I think that word would apply, because as we know, most parasites, they need a warm body or a plant or something to feed on, to maybe lay eggs in, and then, you know, like maggots and insects do that, and I guess this would qualify a virus as a parasite, would it not?
It is parasitic. It's parasitic to its host. Most viruses are pretty specific as to what their host is, like the tobacco mosaic virus is parasitic to, obviously, the tobacco plant, other plants as well, but primarily the tobacco. That's where it was first isolated and identified. You know, it is parasitic, but it's not an active parasite. Hmm. You know, it's not. It doesn't have the ability to move. I mean, it gets carried maybe via airborne mechanism, or you come in contact with it, or it's in, you know, in water, or, you know, in a stream, and then you come in contact with it. But on its own, it's pretty passive, and so there's until it attaches itself to its host, it has no mechanism for getting into the host, other than it's got to attach to it, and then it changes the host cell, and then it injects, like I said, its genetic information into the host.
Well, another thing that I tend to equate with a living creature is a cycle of life. You know, there's birth, and then there's growth, and there's maturity, and then there's death at some point. Does a virus ever die?
Well, it can die. I mean, if it got heated, for example.
Oh, wait a second, but it's not alive. Maybe I posed that question wrong. If a virus, who is absent a host, I mean, does it just persist forever?
It depends on the environment. Hmm. You know, it could. If it's in the frozen tundra, for example, it could be there for, you know, eons in time and still survive. Given the right conditions, it will survive. But this is organic material, we know that, you know, both RNA viruses and DNA, you know, viruses, they are susceptible to the environment, to breaking down. Hmm. But the protein coats around these things help stabilize the DNA. It's interesting, because we, even in our DNA, we have the DNA is coated with protein, not only to stabilize it, but to help it function as being able to express the right genes at the right time. It's really interesting. I mean, the one question that one could ask is, where did viruses come from?
You know, where was the first virus? Yeah, you would have had to have life along with it, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, because a virus by itself just happening to show up doesn't make any sense. Some have speculated that, life, this was early forms of life started like a virus, for example. It started with RNA, maybe, and it was kind of virus-like, but that doesn't make any sense, because that would require all the machinery that is within the cell. And I think as we've talked on this program before, it takes a whole lot of machinery, and it has to be extremely well organized in order to reproduce or to make copies of the DNA, for example, or the RNA, in order to be able to function and in order to be able to reproduce. So while the virus, while a virus can infect a cell and then take over its machinery and start making copies of itself, it doesn't have the ability, obviously, to build any of the internal structures. The only thing that it's making and using the cell for a very short, relatively short period of time, is to make more RNA or DNA, and then to make more proteins that will then coat the RNA in DNA. So when the cell, dies because its whole mechanism has been taken over, and the cell bursts, or lyse as it's called, then the more virus particles are released. And if it happens to be a human host, then that's the time when, if we have a viral infection, for example, that's the time when we get the chills and the fever, is because we've got a lot of viruses being released into our system at that time. So even our bodies tell us that, hey, there's something strange going on here. And our temperature rises, and we get a lot of immune response, for example, at the time when the cells are bursting forth and more viruses are getting into our system.
So does a virus have a life cycle then? I mean, otherwise it just waits for a host to be breathed in or injected or somehow come in contact with a living... I guess it's a poor choice of words to say it has a life cycle. It kind of waits. It's persistent in a way that is not life. This is really weird when I think about it.
Well, it is, but it isn't, because we've got plenty of examples of, let's say, packets of DNA kind of sitting around until the right conditions come along. Because take, for example, consider the seed. From mm-hmm. any plant, a seed it's got a shell. It's got the DNA of that plant is encapsulated in it depends on the plant that we're talking about and how mm-hmm. big it is, but some of them are extremely small, and it waits around until it gets some moisture and the soil conditions and the temperature is right, and then the outside of the seed shell gets soft, and then the information inside the seed, it allows it to start multiplying and growing.
Well, could if plants are alive, then are seeds alive? That is, even before they start growing or taking root?
It has the... this goes to... Mm-hmm. It's not alive at the time. Because it's not metabolizing energy, for example. It's not producing sugar or have the ability to convert sunlight into sugar. Mm-hmm. It has the potential, for life. And, I guess it's the same way as a human egg. Is a human egg alive? Well, no, it's not. It's not alive. It has the potential. A fertilized egg, on the other hand, is alive because it is metabolizing. The metabolism has already started. Mm-hmm. Has started. Once the egg is fertilized, it's the machinery inside the cell says, okay, it's like somebody turned on the switch. And it's the same thing, with the seed. Once the right conditions come along. Now, the difference between a seed and a virus, so let's clarify this, is that the seed itself has everything that it needs to start life. It doesn't rely on a host. It doesn't need the mechanisms and the machinery, if you will, of a host, because it's already got the machinery there.
Mm-hmm. It just needs to be activated somehow, warmth and moisture, I suppose.
Yeah, it needs to be activated with obviously water and the right conditions. And then once those conditions come along, because if we take a normal life cycle of a plant, for example, flowers, I mean, the plants will produce flowers, the flowers produce seeds, the seeds fall to the ground. Those seeds don't automatically start sprouting up again. Well, some of them do, depends on where you are, but let's say in your part of the country or our part of the country, they remain dormant until the next growing season. So, cold comes and it's too cold for the seed to actually activate. And there's something inside the seed that kind of tells it that, hey, no use breaking forth at this point in time because I'm just going to freeze. Mm-hmm. So, it kind of sits there, waiting until the sun starts beating down on the ground and the frost is gone and the snow is gone. And now, the earth starts warming up. And then when it gets to that critical temperature and there's moisture around, that's when the seed starts, opening up and you start getting, your first, taproot that goes down, and you first get your first shoot that goes up towards the warmth, and life for that plant begins at that time. But the virus doesn't have that ability. It could be it could get as warm as it needs, but it still doesn't have the mechanisms necessary to actually produce life on its own.
Now, lest people think we're just talking semantics here, and I think of the word dormant maybe not applying to seeds. I mean, you just used it there, but I frogs and people who, or not people, but animals who hibernate essentially go into a dormant state, whether it's sleep or near death, like frogs and amphibians do in the mud under the snow during the winter. That dormant still implies that there's life going on. But this whole matter of semantics is important when it comes to a definition of human life. And I'm thinking, why is it so difficult for us as a culture to define the point at which human life begins? And where's the wrinkle here? Where's the objection to the scientific definition of life when it comes to human life?
Well, it's... I don't think anyone would argue that once the egg is fertilized that you have life. There are some that would argue, it doesn't look like a human. It doesn't take long for a fertilized egg to look like a human. It's within a couple of weeks it's starting to sprout little finger buds and you can see the process of the hands and the head and the eyes being formed. It doesn't take long at all, but is it capable of living, let's say, outside the womb at that time? Well, no. That's why God placed the fetus inside the womb so it would be nourished in a protective environment until it was capable of living outside. And this is not uncommon for life.
Well, let's split hairs here then, as I really want to dig into this morning. If it can be defined as being alive after fertilization, can it be defined as being human at that point?
Well, it certainly has the full potential for being a complete human being. Now, that question is, you have to ask yourself, what is being human, mean? Because it's human, we are a human being. What does it mean to be a being? Some people would say, okay, that's a cat being, but we don't say cat beings, we say cats, or that's a dog, we don't say dog beings. So, the for me at least, I don't know about our listeners, but for me, the term being means that you've got, there's an essence of you that is different than the rest of the animal world. That essence is your ability, the image that God has placed within you to give you abilities that that other animals don't have. The ability to be creative, the ability to be artistic, the ability to speak. Now, one could argue that, oh, dolphins could talk to each other and they could communicate. Well, communication is one thing, but to speak and to communicate thoughts and ideas and concepts and to be able to construct, to create new things. We have the ability to, build computers and program computers and all the stuff that technology that man has created, the ability to even make a house that can withstand, let's say, tornadoes and things, electricity, to discover the natural phenomena around us and to use electricity and magnetism and light to achieve certain goals for us. That essence, if you will, is completely different than any other living creature here on Earth. Plants certainly don't have that ability. Oh, plants respond to their environment. The sun, as the sun is setting, a plant will follow the sun. But it's not from an intellectual point of view. It's what was already built into the plant that,
the plant has no choice in the matter.
Yeah, it's going to follow the sun because it's trying to collect. I mean, it's not an intellectual process. It's just a mechanism that's already built into it. But we have the ability. I mean, we can follow the sun or we can't follow the sun. I mean, we can move to cold climates or we can move away from cold climates. We can build various forms of transportation, this type of stuff. So what is it that makes us different? Of course, people would say, well, we're no different than an animal. And to them, I would say that is a very illogical conclusion because everything that humans do is not everything. Of course, we have animalistic tendencies, some folks, in destroying one another, and we're probably better at destroying ourselves and destroying other things than even some of the animals, but I'm not going to get into that philosophical argument. But everything that a human does is so much different than your animal that's your dog or your cat or any of the animals, that we see and experience around us, that you have to come to the conclusion that there's something different about us. Well, Genesis tells us what that difference is. And, that difference is explained in chapter 2 of Genesis as God breathed life into us. It's the breath, the very breath of God that's in us. Now, whether you want to call it a soul or a spirit, I believe that is indeed the spirit that God gave us. That makes us different than the creation around us. And so, therefore, if we're made in the image of God, then we are a special creation. And we are given the right to be called a being, for example.
Would you agree that if we are a special creation, not only are we a special creation as being of the mankind, but also as an individual, that each individual is different from every other individual in some ways?
Oh, of course we're and that's the beauty of God's creation, is that while, you know, we have two eyes and we have some of us have hair, some of us don't have hair, you know, on top of our heads or our chinny chin chins, you know, that we have the same characteristics, you know, five fingers and, you know, that type of things. But we are all quite unique. Now, we have seen people that may look like us, and there might even be some folks that get confused and say, "Oh, hey, Joe, and you know, my name is Don. I'm not Joe," and they would swear that, you know, "I'm Joe, but I'm not Joe. I'm Don." And so, you know, we have some physical characteristics that might look like another person. And we certainly look like our fathers or our mothers or a combination thereof. But we are individuals. We are different. God has given each of us, you know, different gifts so that we might... It's almost as if he designed us to live in groups. He designed us to live in a family, for example. He designed us to live in a community where we each contribute our part. But we are designed to live, if you will, in harmony so that we can all survive and produce a better life for one another. So, yes, that difference is there, and that's what makes us unique as an individual.
And of course, the Bible says we each have a plan and a purpose given to us or on the part of God. If God makes a Zika virus, would you describe a purpose for such an elementary life form? Or we go back to the beginning, non-life form as a virus? I mean, does it serve a function, a purpose, or just does it have an effect? Is there a difference between the two? I mean, this can't be an accident.
Well, the question is, when did viruses come along, or bacteriophages, for example, or bacteria and all of this? There is a purpose for taking something that is sick, for example, and breaking it back down into the elements so that, you know, that organic matter could be reused for new life. The question, did viruses, I think, you know, an interesting question is, did viruses and, like, you know, parasites, if you will, non-living parasites, you know, come into existence after the fall? Or were they there from the very beginning?
Good question. Interesting.
You know, I don't know the answer to that.
Are there beneficial viruses? There are beneficial bacteria. Does the same apply to viruses?
I'm not aware of any beneficial viruses. Now, it's interesting that you would say that, because when I was actively involved in biochemistry and doing, biotechnology, for example, there were several labs that were looking at potential viruses, for example, and using them to inject genetic information into, let's say, a person that their particular gene for that expressed, you know, something was defective. And so you could use a virus to inject that or infect that person, if you will, and kind of recode their DNA with the good stuff.
Now, is that what inoculations are? Is that a virus or is that a bacteria? When you get inoculated?
No, the inoculations are actually proteins, denatured, some of them denatured proteins, and particles of, let's say, bacteria or particles of viruses, like the protein coat, for example, that your body then makes antibodies to, so that you are ready to fight influenza virus, for example, the next go-round, if you will, you're better prepared for it because you've already got antibodies against it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it takes our bodies a little while to make antibodies to something that infects it. And so when you get inoculated for the polio virus, for example, you're given proteins, like the protein coat for the polio virus, and then your body makes antibodies towards it. So when or if the polio virus, you should come in contact with the polio virus, you've got a store of antibodies ready to go to just latch on to it and to immobilize it and defeat it before it has a chance to infect your cells.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what an inoculation is. But this is, you're actually allowing a live, you can't even speak about this, you're actually allowing a viable virus, but you're putting, you know, good DNA, if you will, in that virus to help replace a defective piece of DNA in an individual. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, to my knowledge, that has not come to pass, but it was an interesting concept to use something like a virus to as a vector, if you will, to how do you get a piece of DNA into someone, and how do you get it into every cell of their body? Mm-hmm. You know, it's a problem, but a virus offers a potentially unique way of doing that.
Go ahead.
Well, where did viruses come from, and what's their purpose? I guess, you know, in some ways, you know, what's the purpose of bacteria and fungus and all this other stuff? And of course, there is good bacteria that we use, and we've got billions of bacteria inside of us, inside of our gut, doing good stuff because they're breaking down the material that we eat, whether it be protein, you know, the meat that we had last night for dinner, or the vegetable material that we had. We don't have the ability to break down lettuce or to break down any type of a lot of the things that we eat, but the bacteria does. And so it breaks it down into smaller pieces, and then we take the small pieces and utilize them to build up our muscles and our cells and give us energy and that type of thing.
Well, here, let's get back to the semantics then. If it's true that we require certain kinds of bacteria to be healthy and actually to survive, does not that make us parasitic too?
What is it? Well, the difference between a parasite and a synergistic relationship. You know, because the bacteria, I mean, we're allowing, essentially, our bodies are allowing the bacteria within us to live, happily. I don't know if a bacteria is happy or sad. Probably not, but, it's growing and it's multiplying.
I hate to think bacteria have emotions. That would disturb me. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, some of them have little tails. That's been. So it's a more of a synergistic relationship in that case. Now, we can kill off that relation. We can stop that relationship by taking antibiotics, a broad spectrum antibiotics, and then we pretty much clean out our gut of all of the, not only, obviously we want to kill the bad bacteria, but the good bacteria as well. So when you've, after you've taken a, done a treatment of antibiotics for some bacterial infection, it's very good to then eat some natural yogurt, for example, and get those probiotics into your system again, so you can rebuild the bacteria colony in your gut. Because actually, it's that we're getting off on this on a different subject, but the bacteria, you know, the bacteria in your gut, for example, and your intestines and stuff is is 50% of your immune system. So when we wipe it out with an antibiotic, then we've just wiped out 50% of our immune system. And while we have killed the bad, hopefully, the bad bacteria that's infected us, we've also wiped out half of our immune system, which means we are now more susceptible to infection than we were before we took the antibiotic.
Mm-hmm. And more susceptible then to virus?
And more susceptible to viruses and, uh-huh, and other things, because you know, these bacteria, you know, fight off everything. I mean, they're chewing chewing organic matter, whatever they come in contact with. Mm-hmm. And that is you know, obviously it's a good thing for us, but it you know, when they're not there, we are at risk of getting in all kinds of infections.
So the conclusion then is that viruses are not living, but they are organic matter, which seems to be almost a contradiction, because I guess I don't understand what organic means now, which we could reserve for another program. I think that would open up, that'd be a whole new book in the encyclopedia for us here. As we as we kind of wend our way along. Don Clark is a bio. Go ahead.
Let me make one other kind of connection here. It would be like the virus is like the computer code for itself,
mm-hmm,
but it has no computer to run in. So it needs our cells, for example, to run the code. And the code says, make more of myself.
That's a great comparison. And, you know, the deeper and deeper we get into computers and things digital, the more it seems that it's a parallel to life itself. And maybe getting us closer to the way God thinks and the way God affects his creation and enforces his will on it. That's, again, a little too deep for me. I'm getting a headache now. This point. Don Clark, a biochemist and a member of the board of Creation Moments. I want to commend their website to you. It's creationmoments.com. You'll find that Creation Moments is a valuable resource for the scientific information that supports the biblical creation story. You can link to their website from ours if you're at brokenroadradio.com this morning. On the right hand side of the homepage, there's a Creation Moments graphic. Click on that. It'll take you there. It will be an experience for you. And just to let you know, they've got a whole new, beautiful new website being designed right now. That'll be active here in just a few more weeks, so looking forward to that, too. And Don, we'll look forward to next Tuesday with you. Appreciate your time today, and thank you for explaining life to us.
Well, hopefully we all understand what life is. I'm not sure that I do, but
Well, we're all a little closer now than we were before.
Yeah.
Take care. We'll see you Tuesday. Okay. Bye-bye.
Very good. You have a great week.